Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
You're listening to this week's excerpt from the Dear Prudence podcast. To get the full-length members-only version every week, join Slate Plus at slate.com/prudypod.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudence.
Dear Prudy. Do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Help.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Dear Prudence Show once again, and as always, I am your host, Dear Prudence, also known as Mallory Ortberg. With me this week in the studio is Charlotte Shane. Charlotte Shane is an author and essayist, the co-founder of Tiger Bee Press, and host of the monthly reading series, Bad Advice from Bad Women. Charlotte, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Mallory.
Thank you so much for being willing to come on the show and to give. I should ask, like, are you planning on giving bad advice today? Are you going to switch it up and try to give good advice? Like, what's your angle?
That's a great question. You know, I didn't even read the questions you sent me. I was just like, I'm going to wing it. I don't want to know anything about anything that's going to happen here.
Thank
I'm not even going to
God, because lately all my guests have been a bunch of tryhards who show up with notes and thoughtful, like, thought out in advanced responses, and I'm sick to death.
No, I'm dirtbag guest host.
Yes.
Like, I'm, you know, that's what I want to channel, that sort of energy. Like, you know, pure slacker, smoking a cigarette, ashing it on the microphone.
Yes, skateboarding in and out of the studio every 5 minutes.
Skateboarding all over around the desk.
Bullying me.
That's me.
In between questions. Just cyberbullying the hell out of me. I can't tell you how much this is just what I have longed for on a personal and a professional level.
A shakeup for 2018. I thought it was time.
Yeah, more guests that are just here to smoke cigarettes and steal my lunch money. Good. So I'm so glad you have no idea what we're going in for. Do you have the questions in front of you? I guess it's a question I should ask.
I have them.
Oh,
I spilled a lot of beer on them.
Great.
But I have them.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, would you please read the very first one, because it's so beautiful. It's
okay.
So good.
Okay. Okay. Subject included, I hope.
Oh, please.
Okay. Subject: kitten versus baby hypocrisy. Dear Prudence, last year I got into a huge fight with my sister about pet adoption. She wanted to buy a purebred kitten from a breeder. I told her it is immoral to buy pets when there are so many adoptable kittens and puppies in kill shelters. We actually stopped speaking for about 2 months over this issue. But then Sis surprised me with the news that she adopted a cat from a shelter, and all was well between us. At Christmas, my husband and I announced to the family that we will be starting IVF treatment soon. Everyone else was happy for us, but my sister got quiet. At the end of the party, she pulled me aside and called me a hypocrite. She said my IVF baby would be an, quote, expensive purebred, and I should adopt an older foster child. Then we bickered about it until our mom told us to shut up. I know my stubborn sister will be raising the issue again. I am sickened that she is comparing a cat and a baby, but part of me can see her logic. What can I say to defuse this situation?
I mean, I agree that the situation should be diffused, you know? Like, that's a good place to start, is to acknowledge that the rhetoric just, you both immediately came out of the gate, like, going 100 miles an hour in terms of rhetoric. I have to admit,
I did read a little bit of the questions.
Oh,
in this
did
one.
You?
Just,
the subject line drew you in? Yeah.
This one I could not resist. Yeah. Kitten, you know, I had to look. This question just rocketed me straight to heaven. I was like, God bless Mallory. This question is like sending me into ecstasy. I think it's perfection. I think I could probably talk about it for an hour, and I'm going to try not to. But know that I could.
Yeah.
If you want me to, I can.
I mean, there's grist for that mill. Like, there's easily an hour's worth of content in here, because these are two very high conflict people. You know, like, the appropriate gif to reply to this is just the classic "that escalated quickly" sort of thing. Like, damn, you guys do not say things halfway to one another. You guys stopped talking because your sister considered buying a cat. Like, that's heavy. I mean, I agree that it is good to adopt kittens or puppies from shelters. I agree that generally speaking, a lot of breeders, you know, contribute to the overpopulation of pets with no homes, and often, you know, don't treat the animals that they breed very well. I sure would draw the line at not speaking to my sister for 2 months over it. So that's one place to start there, is like, in the future, when somebody does something or talks about contemplating doing something that is not, you know, the best possible good, rather than saying that is immoral and I won't speak to you, you know, save that for the really bad stuff. Save that for, like, I saw a kitten today and I ran over it with my car. Absolutely. You know, stop talking to your sister at that point. And, you know, you can still make a case for, like, hey, I actually think that breeders are a bad idea, and here is a little more information about that if you want to learn more. I sure encourage you to adopt a kitten from a shelter. Rather than, it is immoral, you monster, I'm hanging up the phone now, get out.
Yeah, I mean, my first suggestion, maybe, perhaps this is too mild to address their concerns, but that the word immoral is maybe not the most helpful word in either situation, and that a better way of thinking about both choices might be kind of like with ethics, which to me feels a little more stable than like immoral. I don't know. To me, I really like thinking about ethics, and there's kind of no bottom to the ethical standards you can hold other people to. So it's kind of actually easy for me to say something like, you know, it's like unethical that you spent $8 on a smoothie instead of giving that $8 to somebody who really needs money. But most of us don't live, you know, with that like frame in mind all the time. And I was just thinking, like, would any, you know, does her sister really want to say that like IVF is immoral? I certainly don't think so. It seems pretty obvious that the letter writer's sister probably has no problems with IVF at all. And what she really objects to was the letter writer inserting herself, perhaps quite stridently, into her own decision-making process, and then not applying that same ethical framework to her own life and choices on a much larger scale.
Right, and really didn't, like, pull her punches, just was like, oh, this is going to be a really great callback. I'm going to get to use her words against her. So, like, you're both really slipping the lead into the boxing gloves and just going for it, which I think is a bad way to try to relate to a sibling, because a sibling is somebody who's going to be a part of your life for a really long time. And also, they know a lot of stuff about you. Intimate, emotional, vulnerable stuff, which means they have a lot of
weapons that they can use to turn on you, which means that if you do get in the habit of speaking to one another like this, you know, you'll probably have a lot of conversations where you're like, and I've had this one locked and loaded for a year, and now I'm going to deploy it and I'm going to devastate you.
Well, the thing I really liked, I actually think I kind of like both of these women a whole lot. and what I like about them is that I think they both are pretty confident in their in how they think about things. Like, I don't know. To me, I'm kind of like, well, I really respect and like that they will confront each other about these things instead of not saying anything, because I actually
think,
speaking of ethics, it's important to like speak up when you object to something. I mean, if I were close to was doing something I thought was unethical, like on an important scale, or that it wouldn't cost them to change their minds, I would try to talk to them about it. Like, if they were going to buy a cat,
sure,
be like, what do you want it for? Like, et cetera, et cetera. But I honestly think that the letter writer has to apologize to her sister, because it sounds like she was a real asshole about the cat thing, and that's what the sister's mad about. Not that the sister doesn't want her to have a baby.
Yeah, and I'll give you that too. I don't believe that these sisters are models of like good, healthy conflict, because, you know, they had like one awful fight about the cat, stopped speaking for 2 months, the other sister gave in, and then they papered over it until the other sister saw an opportunity to like sucker punch her right back. So, you know, this is not like, oh, we have this like really healthy, ongoing, honest conversation with one another. Like, this is, we paper over stuff and then we explode.
I didn't say they were models, but I also know people who like really exist in a very heated and like direct way of communication, which is of course not how my family was at all. But I kind of like, I guess in my head, if I could orchestrate like the perfect conversation between these two to diffuse the situation, mm-hmm. I would kind of want them to be able to figure out a way to actually talk to each other, like about their decision making in a healthier way, but in a way that's not like, well, we can't even talk about when somebody does something we think is like not a great choice, you know?
Right. Like to have an option in between, we either don't discuss important issues or,
right,
you know, we come out swinging. No, I absolutely think that's true. And actually, I agree with you. I do think the first, you know, like volley needs to be, hey, you know what? I really need to apologize how I spoke to you about the way that you were getting your cat. I like was really hard on you. I stopped talking to you. You know, I shouldn't have done that. That was really shitty. And I'm sorry.
It's just great that the letter writer is like, my stubborn sister is definitely going to bring this up again. It's like, okay, I don't think your sister is the only stubborn one. I don't think you can like one-sidedly.
Yeah,
you know.
I think you guys have a lot in common.
Yeah.
Yeah. So go ahead and apologize, you know, sincerely. And then, you know, once you have done that, and like wait until you can speak calmly about it, because this is going to feel really heated, right? Because whenever someone contemplates having a child, they get really intense really fast because it feels really personal. And so the idea that somebody else might not want you to have a child feels really like threatening to your well-being. So, you know, apologize, you know, get that handled, and then, you know, just say like, hey, I also want to be able to talk about IVF, and like if you have concerns or if you like want to talk to me about, you know, what your opinions are on like the relative like cost expenditure that we'll be putting out, like I want to be able to have that conversation. But, you know, just like as a sort of ground rule, please don't refer to any hypothetical child of mine as an expensive purebred. Like, let's just take that kind of language off the table. Right.
Like, and
that's a reasonable request. Like,
Yeah. Yeah, maybe don't refer to any human as a purebred ever.
Right. Let's not get into eugenics. Let's just not.
Yeah. No, I feel optimistic about these two, and I just kind of like them. And I love that the letter writer was honest enough to say that even though she wanted to have all this, you know, take umbrage at her sister calling her out, that she actually says, I understand her point.
That kind of like respect of like, all right, you got me good. Like, you did use my own words against me.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of love them. I don't want them to not talk for 2 months again. I think that they sound really smart, and I like them both. I want them to be happy. But I think the letter writer needs to apologize, and then they can like call a truce and combine their powers for good.
Yes.
You know,
and
for making
like,
good ethical decisions.
If you guys are both in the habit of kind of like going really hard to just like end a conversation, conversation, you can always pause and say, like, I am getting really heated right now. I love you. I know I'm going to say something that I will regret later. Can we take five on this one? I'm going to take a walk around the block and then we'll try again. And like, if you want to say, it feels really painful to me, you know, because I really want to have a biological child and I'm willing to invest this much money and time into it. Like, I'm willing to have a conversation about it. But at a certain point, I do want to ask that you respect if that's a decision I choose to make, that that is a decision I can make. That's something I can prioritize. It's not an objectively right or objectively wrong thing. That's fair to do, too. So, you know, set limits. Take time out when you need them. If you feel yourself on the verge of saying something really painful to your sister, you know, like, call for a reset. And, you know, good luck. You guys sound like you both want to do a little bit better. And the good news is there's a lot of room for diffusing because you guys definitely both have a history of whatever the opposite of diffusing is. Infusing? Fusing. a lot.
Infusing, yeah.
All right. So this next letter, the subject line is just this. So happy for you. Dear Prudence, I'm a single gal in my mid-30s who's had a tough go of it romantically. In the past 5 years, I've had two engagements hit the skids, and I'm currently experiencing a severe dating slump. Meanwhile, everyone in my close circle of friends has gotten or is about to get married, and a lot of them are having kids already. While I love my friends, I'm finding it harder to participate in their happy life events as it reminds me what I'm missing out on. I'm hoping you can help me find a way to express this difficulty to my friends. Every time I get an invitation for an engagement party, baby shower, or child's birthday party, I can feel my spirit crashing. It's like a reminder of what I don't have but so badly want and makes me feel left out. In the past, I've attended these events because I wanted to support my friends, even though it would leave me feeling depressed for the rest of the day. It's a new year and I'm inspired by the potential of new opportunities ahead, but I don't want to consciously put myself in a situation that I know will make me anxious and upset anymore. It's also tougher to come up with new excuses as to why I can't go. When the next invite for a shower or party comes in the mail, what's a nice way for me to let the sender know that I appreciate being included? And it's nothing personal, but it's just too hard on me mentally to attend these types of occasions.
I thought that there's like a pretty straightforward solution to this.
I'm wondering if
you're going to agree.
I love straightforward solutions.
I think she should just tell her friends how she feels. I don't think it's going to be a big deal. Like, and if that feels too vulnerable, because there are different, you know, sort of like levels of friends, so to speak, you know, if she's like has varying intimacy with these people and it feels kind of like too exposed to tell some of them what's going on, that you don't have to give an excuse if you don't go to something. You can just say, you know, thank you so much for this invitation. Like, I wish I could be there. I'm not going to be able to. And then you can also say, like, but I would love to see you and take you out to lunch or whatever else. And the odds are if her friends are pregnant or about to get married, they're probably too busy to take her up on that offer, but it will affirm that she, you know, that they're important to her and that she wants to be part of their lives.
Yeah. Yeah. I think especially there's sort of a sorting algorithm you can apply to this. Like, an engagement party falls a little higher up on the scale of things that it might be important to at least make an appearance at versus like somebody's second child's second birthday party. You can really give that one a miss, you know, like as great as kids are, you know, somebody's like first or second birthday party is sort of like they vaguely experience shapes. I actually am not a specialist in child development. They might experience other things, too. But a lot of these are opt out. And I actually totally agree, especially with your close friends. You know, that doesn't mean necessarily that you're like, I'm never going to go to any of your weddings or celebrate anything. I'm out. It's canceled. But you can certainly share just like, hey, I'm going through kind of a rough time and I love you and I want to see you. But I've been to like 8 engagement parties this last year and sometimes it's a little painful for me. So maybe I'm going to come by for the first hour and then scoot. And I'd love to maybe just like check in a little more often and share how I'm doing. And hopefully your friends will take you up on that, because that's okay to say, like, not that it's, you know, your fault that I'm going through a difficult time or that I can't experience joy for you, but that collectively this is kind of taking a toll on me. Like, I think that's fine, especially if it's somebody you're really close with.
Yeah. I mean, it seems corny, but you can always tell someone the important thing, which is like, I care about you. I want to stay a part of your life. Like, you don't have to tell them the unimportant stuff, which is that, like, I'd love to come to your party, except that it's going to really depress me. Or, like, in my case, like, I'd love to come to your party, but I'm really lazy and I'm not a very social person and, you know, X whatever else. Like, you can just tell them the important thing, which is like, I'm so glad you invited me. You mean a lot to me. It sounds corny, but I don't know. People surprisingly like hearing that they matter to other people.
Yeah.
So I don't think your relationships need to suffer just because you don't want to attend these things all the time.
And I'll just throw in, like, in addition to this, it sounds like you're already working hard on kind of tending to yourself and setting limits and focusing on what's to come, which is great. You know, I also just want to throw in a plug for invest in one or two of your friendships with other single people. Obviously, there's no guarantee that your other single friends won't eventually have a child or get married, but it is great when you have at least one or two other people in part of your circle of friends who are kind of experiencing the same thing you are. And so that not everyone that you're close with is, you know, a young parent who's really busy and deeply involved with their, you know, new family. That might go a long way towards making you feel kind of seen and heard and understood and having a friend who is like free to get, you know, coffee in the afternoon without having to arrange for childcare or like or arrange things with their partner. Like, that might also help.
Yeah, it'll be okay. I really feel like the thrust of this letter was sort of like, I'm sad, which is okay. It was really touching and sweet. I hope you feel better soon.
Yeah, I felt
your
honest.
Friends will be there for you. It's okay.
Yeah, it didn't feel like deeply resentful. It didn't feel like I've been letting this fester so long that I kind of hate everybody now. It's just simple and honest. And I hope that if you share some of that with your friends, that they will, you know, respond with compassion and love. And I'm sorry, yeah. That is
and
a lot.
And dates, if you want.
Like two,
they might set you up.
Yeah, two called off engagements in the last 5 years. That's painful. I'm sorry. I'm glad you didn't end up marrying those people because I imagine that would have gone really badly. But that's rough. So I hope the new year holds something better for you. Charlotte, you should know I have had this one sitting in like a Google Doc limbo for 6 months because all I have been able to come up with in reply to this one is, you have to tell us who the famous guy is. Like, that's all I've been able to get to. Every, like, week, I imagine it with a different famous guy.
Oh, that's really fun. Well, who is it this week?
You know, it's actually, the game's gotten less fun in the last month or two, just given the national
Six
conversation
months is a
around
long time to keep
famous gentlemen. Yeah. So I don't think it's anybody right now, but it's been a lot of really fun. Just like actors, I think, are handsome, basically, is what I've been imagining so far. But it's your turn to read, and I'm really excited for you to get to read it. And I'm curious if I will actually have an answer for this person or if I will just want like a follow-up request for more gossip.
Okay, I'm ready. The subject is blind item. Dear Prudence, I have a long-standing friends with benefits situation with a man substantially wealthier, more famous, read at all, and powerful than I am. This has been going on for about 8 years now. We live on separate coasts, so we've literally slept together twice in all that time, but we email and text fairly often, including not only sexy time stuff, but some really intimate confessional conversations. When we met, we were both married. His marriage fell apart, something he blames/credits me for, which is silly because I am clear-eyed enough to know he screwed around all the time. My own marriage has held. My husband knows what has happened, at least the physical encounters, and while he's not thrilled, he lives with it. He's had his own infidelities, which I'm semi-okay with, and I guess you could define our relationship as not exactly open, but tolerant. Also, he's a fan of this guy, so it's sort of one of those freebie list situations. So here's the problem. I don't want to run away with this guy or anything, but I think about him in high dudgeon every day. I know he thinks about me occasionally too, but he also has moved on to a new serious girlfriend, 20 years his junior, manic pixie type, but now I'm being petty. And the power differential is pretty extreme. We both recognize that, sometimes ruefully, sometimes thrillingly, but it obviously doesn't hit home in the same way with him as it does with me because, you know, power differential. Is there any way for me to maintain this lovely, bantering, occasional relationship I have with him and not feel needy and hurt when he drops out for long periods to deal with his busy, glamorous life?
Okay, so I actually do have somebody that I'm picturing right now, by the way, because as you were reading this, I Googled who are famous men dating much younger women, which is a very long list of famous men.
All of them. Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's a lot. But I'm going with Jason Statham.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm picturing Jason Statham and just in between Fast and Furious movies, he texts this woman and then jets off to film more, you know, vaguely, what is it? What is his shtick? Like almost indie action movies, right? He's like the thinking man's action man. Is that it?
Yeah, that sounds right. Like he sounds like the type of guy who's in, you know, like Where's the Briefcase Now movie.
Where's the Briefcase Now? That is the best description of a kind of movie that I really enjoy. Even though it's always the same kind of movie. But yeah, so this is about Jason. It is not about Jason Statham. I apologize. I don't mean in any way to impugn the good name of Jason Statham. That's just who I am choosing to picture as we read this letter. Who are you going to picture? Who's your guy?
Oh, I was picturing someone kind of, I was about to say old, but that might not be okay. Like 60s-ish with like a beard and kind of heavy, but like wearing a suit a lot.
So like Oliver Sarkozy, who is dating one of the Olsons. I forget which one.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Perfect.
Yeah. Perf. Oh my God. That's literally who it is. He's dating a younger manic pixie type. That's him.
Yeah. Yeah. Or it could be Alec Baldwin, except I kind of have a hard time imagining that he's like a lot of fun to text with, you know?
I know. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, he doesn't seem like a fun texter. All right, yeah. I'm gonna stop guessing because that is not what this person like asked us to do. To speculate, it could be Bruce Willis.
Yeah. Oh, that's kind of sexy. I like that.
I mean, I really need to stop just guessing. Is what I need to stop.
But it also does have to be a guy that other guys admire. So
yeah.
Sarkozy is probably out.
Yeah. Yeah. For a while I was trying to picture like John Stewart or somebody, but he's just married to his wife. So, Jeff Goldblum. Okay. I'm done. It's Jeff Goldblum. That is who we are going to picture as we answer this letter, which we have not done at all. But this woman has been seeing Jeff Goldblum on and off for 8 years. But they've only slept together twice. Congratulations on sleeping with Jeff Goldblum. What's your read on this? How do you see this as a lovely, bantering, occasional relationship? Because, spoiler alert, I sure don't.
Okay, yeah. Here's where I'm at with this. I think this whole emphasis on, like, the power differential is a bit of a red herring. Because I think really the only salient power differential between them is that she really enjoys feeling kind of infatuated with him, and he is probably super distracted most of the time, and he probably, you know, speaks to her when it's convenient and when he like is idle or like really needs to, that she's kind of his like on-call therapist slash like lover, and for him he's or for her, pardon me, she's like, I'm sorry, all my pronouns are, this is why we should all just use they there all the time. For her, he is more of like a constant escape and something she really enjoys fantasizing about, and something that feels, I think, like really hot and special for her to have in her life. So the significance for her is huge, but I don't think it's because he has like more power. I mean, it doesn't sound like he's like exploited her somehow. It's just that like his stature helps him become an extra appealing fantasy object.
Right. Right. He has this whole life that she's kind of envious of. Like, he got out of the kind of lousy marriage. And, like, the way that this letter writer describes her marriage is, like, we're not thrilled. We live with it. I'm semi-okay with this. I guess you could define our relationship as tolerant. It's sort of one of those situations. Like, there's a lot of emotional inertia when she describes her marriage. And, like, it may be that you love your husband very, very much. I'm not trying to suggest that you don't like the guy or that you guys should get divorced. It just sounds like you have imbued this other dude with, he's got all this freedom. He's always jet setting off to other places. He gets to replace his kind of lousy marriage with like a beautiful younger girlfriend. He gets to do all the things I wish I could do. And so that's part of what is giving him all of this power. Because, like, right, as you said, it doesn't sound like he is, like, you know, sending a jet to, like, steal you away from work or trying to, like, in some way exploit his fame and wealth, aside from just being like, this adds to my charisma. But it sounds like you're really envious of the way in which he gets to conduct his personal life. And I would say, you know, use that envy to do something other than just wait for him to text every couple of months. like pursue the things that you want with the same intensity that he pursues the things that he wants, which, you know, we have to be frank, are kind of not really you. Like he enjoys talking to you sometimes. He enjoys sleeping with you once every 4 years, or twice in 8 years. You know, like he pursues the things that he wants, and he's pursued you as much as he wants, which is kind of on the fringes of his life. And he's that doesn't seem likely to change. So, you know, that's not to say that you have to stop talking to him tomorrow, but like, you know what you're going to get from this guy. Like, there is nothing about him that is not a known quantity. He is not going to suddenly surprise you. He is not suddenly going to get more interested in like deepening your connection. He's not going to drop the hot young manic pixie type girlfriend. So, you know, if you are not up for another 8 years of this, the change is going to have to come from you, because it's not going to come from him, because he's getting everything he wants out of the situation. So, you know, I would say this is not an occasional relationship. You think about him every day in high dudgeon. So, you know, you say you don't want him to run away with him, but like, I kind of don't buy that. I think you at the very least want him to show up at your door with a helicopter and say, like, I left the girlfriend, I threw everything away. Do you want to run away together? And you want to have that moment of deciding. Like, you don't necessarily want to go with him, but you want him to ask. You want him to say, like, I have all these things, but you know what? Your text messages are just so compelling. I dropped them all, and I want to just, like, move to the moon with you. Either so that you can be like, hell yes, let's, like, fuck everything and go, or so you can be like, no, I've outgrown you. I'm the one with the power now. Give me the helicopter and fuck off. Both of which are very powerful fantasies, and neither of which are gonna happen. So my question to you is this really lovely? Like, are you really getting anything out of this? Like, yes, you send flirtatious texts once in a while. Yes, it helps kind of like let the steam off of this marriage that you sort of resent. But like, if you want something different out of the next 8 years, what are you going to do to get those things? Is my question to you, letter writer.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard this, that like people who gamble, like, what's the word? Casually, like people who aren't like addicts, but who like gambling, will always say that when you gamble, you have to sort of think of the money you put down as like you're paying to play the game. Not that like this is my money that I'm going to collect at the end, because you're not going to collect at the end, or like here's my chance to get rich, because you're not going to get rich. You have to be like, this is what I'm putting in to have this experience. And that's what I was thinking about with her letter. I was like, you know, he's using her, but she is using him, because she gets this like incredibly fulfilling fantasy life and like this fun secret. And I feel like I've had that before. It's super compelling. It's like, I mean, you're basically like on drugs all the time, but it's going to hurt a lot. You know, so her end question was sort of like, can I still have this and not be hurt? And my answer would be no, you know, you can't. Like, it's going to end badly unless, as you said, Mallory, you kind of take the steps to start weaning yourself off of it, which you don't need to do. It's like, I mean, I say you don't need to do, just because if the letter writer is more or less happy, or if the letter writer is willing to put up with the sensations of suffering, if this kind of like extreme back and forth is part of what makes it like
thrilling,
intoxicating for her, mm-hmm. Yeah, and like part of what feels like passion to her, then maybe she doesn't need to end it. But she should be realistic about like, this is the ride I keep buying the ticket for, you know, not that like, yeah, maybe someday he's going to Christian Grey me away from my tolerant husband.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that makes a lot of sense. Like, it doesn't sound like, you know, this isn't ruining your life. You're not miserable every day. But it does take a toll on you. So I think the question you need to put to yourself is, this is what I get when I engage with this guy. I get the powerful secret. I get the feeling that I'm like escaping from the realities of my marriage. I get to feel like super involved with this person that I find very emotionally and physically compelling. And the other things that I experience are sometimes he drops me and that hurts. And I get to watch like the goings on of his personal life, because he lives his life in public in a way that I don't. So I sometimes feel like, you know, a little Dickensian orphan staring through a window at like a bit rich baron, like eating a turkey leg. And if that's something that you're willing to do a little bit, you know, set some limits. Don't always respond immediately to the emails. Figure out other things in your life that you would like to change. Invest in different relationships. Have long, intimate, confessional conversations with other people who maybe live near you and are not, you know, Jeff Goldblum. And put him in a slightly smaller box that you can, like, you know, enjoy the hit more, right? Like when you do finally decide to take that drug. Or if you're like, wow, actually, I don't like what I have put into this for the last 8 years. I don't want another 8 years of this. Maybe just kind of like wish him well. And, you know, again, you don't have to say like, I'm never speaking to you again. You're a jerk and you've taken advantage of me, because you've both used each other. But you can just kind of say like, I want help from either my partner or my friends or a therapist in no longer investing in this guy, no longer like ponying up to this game. I want to use that energy to do something else. And if that's what you want, you know, the good news is you clearly have a lot of energy that you're about to free up if you stop talking to him so often. And I have every faith in your ability to like get your own helicopter. That's definitely, I think, my personal preference, but all of those are options, you know, that you have available to you. And then most importantly, please write back and tell us who it is. We will not publish on the air, but I am a very nosy person and I want to know.
Yeah. Go get that helicopter, girl.
Yeah. Get that helicopter. It's going to be a lot more fun than Jeff Goldblum, who I'm sure is great. Sorry, Jeff.
You don't believe that, Mallory. You don't like Jeff Goldblum.
I know. I've seen what you put Jeff on the Goldblum. Internet. I am baffled by the insistence that I get from so many people that they're attracted to him. I don't believe it. I think they're lying to me. I don't understand why they're lying to me about this. It makes no sense to me.
Wait, just real quick. Who is like a hot guy you think everyone should be attracted to?
I don't think there's anyone everyone should be attracted to. But like, Jeff Goldblum can't be the guy. He can't be the guy that everyone is like. It makes sense that everyone's like, The Rock is hot. I'm like, yes, of course. We should all agree on some level that The Rock is hot, of course. But I don't believe it when people tell me that they're wild about Jeff Goldblum. All right, last letter. Let's do this. Charlotte, you in?
I'm ready.
Yeah.
Okay, subject. Go if you must, but we are staying. Dear Prudence. Through hard work and very good luck, I was able to retire in my mid-30s. I decided to continue working, but remotely, and with a lot of control over the intensity of my job. I met my now wife, we picked a city to move to, and had two kids. We spend summers in another part of the country and travel a lot. My wife took a job in a new field. My flexible work allowed me to take primary responsibility for childcare. Recently, she was approached with a job offer. But the job is in a city pretty universally regarded as an undesirable place to live. Comes with little vacation and no freedom to work outside the office. I don't want to move or give up summers away, and the kids are even more adamant. They love their school and have great friends here. My wife doesn't want to hear it and was basically laughing off our objections to do online house shopping. Finally, I told her flat out that while she could move wherever she wants, the kids and I are going to stay. She can commute, come back a couple weekends a month, if she feels the job is so important to her. We can afford the extra costs, though they will probably be greater than what she'll earn. I have no problem dealing by myself with the kids' day-to-day needs. See, she seemed shocked, but what she wants to do goes against everything we agreed upon when we got married. Shouldn't family come before career when the career isn't a financial necessity? Isn't the burden on the party that wants to make a big change to convince everybody else?
I do kind of love this idea that there is like a standard to how all marriages have to work, and that like I'll be able to say like, yes, she has violated the original compact of your marriage, and as such, you win.
It's like, speaking of people who haven't been to therapy, like if this guy brought those questions to a therapist, I'd be like, the first thing they would be like, we're not answering those. Those aren't right. Even, we're just going to pretend you didn't even say those. Because the whole letter really feels like what he wants you to say is, yeah, you are right and your wife is wrong. End of story, period. Like, enough.
Right. And what she is choosing is career before family, right? Like, the only options are not move, prioritize family, or move and throw our family into the sun. Like, you know, it kind of goes back to what you were saying in the beginning about, like, it's not so much immoral versus moral as it is. There's a lot of different options with a lot of different ethical frameworks. there are reasons to move. There are reasons not to move. There are things that would be challenging about it. There are also things that would be probably great about it. It would not necessarily, it's not necessarily, you know, you're on the side of family, she's on the side of career. Like, she is also a part of the family. Her happiness in her job is a part of your family. I'm not saying you have to do it. I'm just saying it's not like this attitude of like, nope, I'm staying with the original confines of our marriage agreement. You are straying outside of it. You are disobedient. I am obedient. I am right. You can either get on board or like fuck off and visit on the weekends.
Yeah, I mean, what it sounded like to me was that from his letter was I'm kind of like, ugh, everyone in this family, like, they sound super spoiled. It sounds like since the inception of the family, none of them have ever had to do something they don't want to do or make a sacrifice. And now the wife is kind of introducing that idea to the rest of them. And they're all like, oh, my God, like, what is this? Absolutely not. This nasty little gross, undesirable city you want to move to. I mean, I don't even know that anyone in the family has been to the city. It really sounds like I'm not going to say the city I was imagining in my head when he said that, but I was like, you need to go visit. Like, you can't just be like, everyone knows that's a trash city. Like,
right,
you need
like,
to go to the city.
When you say universally regarded, I have a pretty good image of what universe you're picturing. And it's not the
exactly.
sum total of
yes.
the universe. It's your other rich
yeah.
friends.
Yes.
And I do
yeah,
detect, like, again, like, I don't want to come down too hard on this letter writer. Like, this is not in the same category as like the last letter writer where I'm like, you need to rethink your whole life. But sometimes people who make a lot of money and retire in their mid-30s get a sense of entitlement of, I have all this money. And so all the, you know, things that I want to do in this marriage, in this family, in this relationship, you know, they carry a little extra weight. And maybe you wouldn't be so crass as to say, like, well, it's my money, my rules. But that's kind of what you're thinking and saying. And I think that that is not a great way to conduct your life. Like, I think if you are trying to bring that energy to your family of like the person who makes the most money, has the most influence, that is like a pretty upsetting power balance to bring to loving relationships. That's not to say that like you shouldn't make decisions like based around financial necessity for your family. Obviously, I'm not saying like you should give your 5-year-old the, you know, ability to buy groceries and have them make all the decisions. But yeah, this idea that like I make all the money and so, you know, it's my way or the highway is I think that's, you know, never add capitalism to love if you don't have to.
As an aside, wouldn't you watch a reality TV show that was just about five-year-olds grocery shopping? Because I would.
100%. That would be the most charming show. I would love the like little interviews afterwards of like, okay, what was your strategy going into the Safeway?
Oh my God.
And how the five-year-old just be like, well, they gave me this many dollars and I like eating things that are purple. It would be very, very adorable. I would watch the heck out of that show.
But yeah, no, sorry. I mean, when I was saying that they all seem spoiled, frankly, I'm including the wife too. It really sounds like they've never had to kind of confront, a situation where somebody in the family might not like the outcome.
Oh, because money
and
smooths
so
over
that,
so many problems.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Like,
yeah.
90%.
It's one of the nice things about it.
One of the, like, 90% of the problems that people experience, like, in this column on this podcast would be fixed if I was just like, oh, by the way, here is a lot of money. Your problem is mostly gone now. Like, the 10% that remains are still really intense, but a lot of them would be solved with money.
I mean, so it seems to me, it's like, okay, yes, it is not unreasonable for you to want your wife to explain to you and your children, perhaps, depending on their ages, why the job is important and appealing to her. But you have to be open-minded about it. You can't already show up being like, this is awful. I'm not going to get to go vacation in the summer. Like, forget about it. You know, you have to be willing to be like, why is this important to you? Like, what do you see this doing for our family? And you know, there's like a way to tell this story that's very whiny and like put out, but there's a way to tell the story that's like, my God, like how incredible that we have so much flexibility that my wife could take a job that actually costs us money and we could still stay together and everyone could get a version of what they want. You know, like, that's remarkable. That's not a bad outcome, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you say that if she feels the job is so important to her, which suggests that you actually don't really know a lot about what about this job appeals to her. So I would say, rather than approaching this in a spirit of, all right, wife, you have 30 seconds, you know, like, this is an episode of Shark Tank. You have 45 seconds to convince me and your wealthy children why we should invest in your stupid career. And otherwise, like, we're throwing you out. Have the overdue conversation, approach this in a spirit of curiosity and ask that she do the same. Say, like, hey, it is clear that we are on really different pages. And I can't promise that we're going to find a great compromise that we both love. But, like, I love you. I want to know more about you. I want to be able to make decisions together with as much information as possible. So talk to me about, you know, this job offer. Tell me more about why you want it. Tell me more about the job that you have right now. Tell me more about what appeals to you about this other city. And listen and pay attention. And after she talks about that, you know, and it's your turn, like, don't just wait for your chance to be like, and here's why it's a lousy idea and you shouldn't do it. Just talk about, like, you know, the job doesn't have a lot of vacation. There's not a lot of freedom. You know, I would be afraid of how this would affect my life. I would be afraid of how this would affect the kids' life. Can we talk about those concerns? Because it may be that she shares some of them. It may be that, like, as a unit, you guys can ultimately decide that this isn't the right next move. But you can't, like, you can't insist that she get in line or, like, fuck off. Or, like, you can, but then you'll probably end up getting divorced. And say, like, yeah, if you want to, you know, I didn't know you didn't like your job. Like, if there's something else you want to change, if you'd rather live in a city, like, let's talk about that. It doesn't have to be necessarily this job right now. Like, we have options. Mostly I just want to know, like, what do you want out of the next couple of years? What do you want out of your career? What are some things that feel really important to you? What are things that feel less important to you? And, like, let's have an ongoing conversation, because I don't want to get caught off guard again where you're at a point where you're ready to, like, click buy on, like, richpeoplebuyhouses.com. And I'm ready to, like, change the locks and say, feel free to come home on the weekends if you must. Like, that's a pretty, it's a pretty big gap between the two of you. And I think that can only be changed by having regular check-in conversations about what you want and what you don't want.
I need to know what they've been doing with all their free time that it's not talking to each other. Is it just drinking martinis and, like, talking about all the undesirable places there are to live? Like, what are they doing with their time?
It feels a little like, you know, those jokes about the episodes of House Hunters International where, like, the couple has a ridiculous amount of money and jobs that don't really explain where it comes from. Like, the guy is like, oh, I, like, restore old starfishes, and the wife is like, oh, I saw a wizard once, and they're like, oh, our budget is $50 million. It's like kind of like that. I don't want to say, like, I don't want to come down too hard on these people, but yeah, it sounds like money has enabled you guys to, you know, kind of scoot over a lot of problems that other couples kind of have to face, and you have maybe substituted in some ways being able to throw money at a problem for relational intimacy, and you've reached a point where you kind of can't do that shortcut anymore because you're not the level of rich where you can buy your wife a private jet and she can just commute every day. So, you know, money's not going to fix this problem. And, like, wielding the fact that you have more money is not going to fix this problem. You're just going to have to actually talk to each other and listen. Just do that. Have that conversation. And if nothing else, like, don't assume that there's a lot of cities that are universally regarded as an undesirable place to live, because everybody lives in a, you know what I mean? Like, at some point, the people who live there, not that everybody is free to move to wherever they want, but I bet if you went to that city and you asked everyone, not every single person would be like, oh yeah, this is objectively the worst place to live on earth. Everyone here hates every second of it. That is a position of contempt.
I don't think we're being too hard on them. I think we're poking a little fun at them, but I don't think we're being mean to them. And having fun poked at you is very character building. Just like moving to a place you don't necessarily want to move to can be very character building.
And very, very rich people often do not have fun poked at them. Or, like, people do it, but, like, they do it on Twitter where the rich people are like, haha, I don't have to look at this. I'm very rich. I'm going to go do something else now.
Right.
So you're going to be fine with all of your money. And none of your conversations. Less money, more conversations in 2018.
Yeah. Money can't buy you conversations.
And money can't buy you compliance in a spouse. You know what I mean? Like, or it can for a while if you keep, like, if someone chucked diamonds at me on a regular basis, they would get a compliant spouse for a pretty long time. But eventually, I would want to do something that they didn't like. And, you know, eventually I would say, like, I'm over this. There's no diamond big enough to keep me from whatever my dumb idea is. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. If anyone out there would like to keep me in diamonds and also just make sure that I don't know, I'm like a trophy spouse, you have weird taste, Aval, but sure, like, let's go for it. I would absolutely not take any jobs that you didn't want me to take. And I would, I don't know, buy a lot of tennis bracelets. I do not know how to be a trophy spouse. So that's my sales pitch for myself. And if anyone...
And that's Mallory's dating ad.
Yeah, so. This whole thing has been a very long episode for, like, do you want a mouthy weirdo who mixes a lot of prints and has, like, hard opinions about how other people should live their life? Well, you are in luck. I am available for going full dynasty. But, you know, just shoulder pads and what is it? Is a tennis bracelet a bracelet you wear while you're playing tennis? Or is it a bracelet that you wear after, like, once you've played tennis, they're like, oh, here's the bracelet everyone who plays tennis gets.
It's like a dime, like a loose, kind of delicate, but not too delicate diamond bracelet. And I'm sure it is, so, like, you wear it while
it's diamonds.
I'm sure it, like, catches the light. Yeah, what? Diamonds. Mm-hmm.
And is it like, okay, do you play it when you are... Do you play it? Do you wear it when you're playing tennis? Or is it like
I'm imagining yes. Because I think like way back in the 90s, ads for tennis bracelets, I know Cindy Crawford was in one. This is why I even know they exist. And I'm pretty sure she was like on the tennis court. And I imagine it's kind of like if you're swinging your arm around in the air and you're playing on like a beautiful open air tennis court.
Yeah.
You know, which of course you are because you're not a commoner. You're not going to play tennis indoors.
No.
Like... that it's catching the light, like it's glint, you know, just glinting off the sunlight. Maybe it's even sabotaging your opponents.
Oh my God. The rich, there's so much I don't know about you. Okay, there is not a Wikipedia entry for tennis bracelets. There's just one for bracelets, but now I'm doing a control F search.
That's not
going to
cut it. Wikipedia, please come through.
Oh, okay. This is amazing. So there's a series of like subsets called types. There is alternative health bracelets, beaded bracelets, charm bracelets, slap bracelets, sports bracelets, and tennis bracelets. Love that slap bracelets are
so
in there.
Good. Yes.
Oh. What? This can't be true. This can't be true. Hang on. This cannot be true. Listen to this. The only listing under the tennis bracelet entry is this. During the 1987 U.S. Open, Chris Evert's diamond line bracelet fell off onto the court. She said about this, "I dropped my tennis bracelet." And since then, diamond line bracelets have been called tennis bracelets. Are you telling me?
Oh, my God.
Are you trying to tell me that Chris Evert's invented the tennis bracelet? I am stunned.
What a blessed discovery.
This feels like...
this Wikipedia entry is.
Okay, so there's... I'm now on... Sotheby's.com, which I feel like you know a lot more rich people than I do. Is that how you pronounce it? Is it Sotheby's? Is it Sotheby's?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you totally, yeah.
Okay, so Sotheby's confirms that the tennis bracelet was immortalized by world-ranked tennis star Chris Evert in 1987. She literally invented calling it tennis bracelets.
The tennis bracelet. That makes sense of why I'm like, oh, I remember Cindy Crawford advertising it in the 90s. This would be like right on the cusp of... tennis bracelet fever.
This is amazing. What a legacy to give to the world. I will never get over this. We're just
yeah. Did
need
you
to...
know that, that no. Your podcast was going to turn into like this,
jewelry
like,
history
investigative discovery?
Oh my God. Like, oh my God. This is
jewelry deep cuts. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, Chris Evert. They halted the game. By the way, she refused to continue playing until the bracelet was found. So they stopped the Grand Slam until they could find, like, the bits of her bracelet on the floor. or ground or whatever the outside is.
Wouldn't you stop whatever was going on so you could, like, collect your diamond bits?
I mean, in the, like, alternate universe where I am a world-ranked tennis champion and also the kind of person who wears diamonds while I am competing at an international level, like, at the top of my game of sports. Yeah, I'm sure I'm also the kind of person who does that. But that is...
100%.
That is not... I have peanut butter in my backpack right now. You know what I mean? Like... Like a jar of peanut butter. I didn't, like, put peanut butter on the inside of my backpack. I just, like, for
comparison. It's not just loose peanut butter.
Yeah, it's not loose peanut butter, but it's definitely, like, I just have a jar of peanut butter in my backpack because that's what I'm going to have for supper.
The whole jar. Like a raccoon.
No,
just
no, no,
a little paw in the jar.
Yeah, I'm much more like a raccoon than, like, a diamond bracelet lady. Okay, we have had the greatest episode of all time, and I'm going to need to cut it short because at this point we're just roasting me, and there's no reason for me to
we're celebrating you. Yeah, we're celebrating you.
We are celebrating and roasting at the same time because I am a raccoon, and that's the kind of advice you are getting if you write to me. Charlotte, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Mallory, for having me.
You are a gift and a dirtbag and a true delight, and I hope that we get to have you back sometime.
I would love it anytime.
All right. Thank you so much. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Max Jacobs. I want to give quick and fulsome thanks to Audrey Dilling, my longtime producer, who is moving on to an exciting new unnamed project and who is already profoundly missed. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. It's not to say that Max Jacobs isn't doing a fantastic job. He already explained to me what tennis bracelets used to be called, so I have a feeling he's going to fit in just fine. Don't miss an episode of the show. Head to slate.com/dearprudence to subscribe. Remember, you can always hear more Prudence by joining Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/plus to sign up. If you want me to answer your question, call me and leave a message at 401-371-DEAR, that's 3327, and you might hear your answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location, and at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. Keep it short, 30 seconds, a minute, tops. If you're looking for more to listen to from Slate, check out Trumpcast. It's a quasi-daily podcast from Slate that sets out to understand the real Donald Trump. Jacob Weisberg, chairman of Slate, along with writer Virginia Heffernan and Slate chief political correspondent Jamel Bowie, talk to historians, psychiatrists, and other experts to help explain who this man is and why this is happening right now in the United States of America. Check out Trumpcast wherever you get your podcasts.